Hello. Welcome to Razor's Edge, local and independent current affairs straight from Sydney on 2SER 107.3. I'm Daniel Butler. Today on the show...
Then you know you've got a real problem, and you can see that in the number of Sydney siders that are really struggling to afford housing.
It's nothing we didn't know already. Sydney has been named the third worst city in the world for housing affordability. The inner city risks becoming a youth-free zone as young people are pushed further and further out. Also on the show today...
It looks at the moment, given the numbers, that it would probably get through as proposed.
The abortion debate is still grinding on in the New South Wales Parliament as multiple amendments are debated. Gladys Berejiklian almost faced a challenge this week, but that one fell apart. We asked the experts where the bill is now. All that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first, strike action will be held worldwide tomorrow to signal society's changing attitudes to coal power and opposition to climate change. The strikes will be held only days before a major summit on climate change will be held at the United Nations. In Sydney, several rallies will be held across the CBD and will converge on the domain at midday for speeches and performances. Kevin Suarez spoke to one of the core members of the New South Wales team for School Strikes for Climate and asked her what first motivated her to join the team.
Last year, I joined the Australian Youth Climate Coalition and I did a student climate leadership program with them. And then I started attending more and more climate events and then just became involved through that. And then after the first strike, I became involved with School Strike for Climate through AYCC.
What did you think about how the world governments have been tackling the issue of climate change?
I don't think any of our governments are doing enough, especially our own Australian government hasn't put in any governmental action in actually providing sustainable climate change policies, because all we're seeing is our economy thriving off of coal instead, and it doesn't need to be and it shouldn't be.
And what do you think should be the change?
I think we need to transition to 100% renewable energies. I know that that's not possible overnight, but I think by about 2030 or at least 2050, we do need to be seeing some sort of transition from this purely coal-thriving economy to renewables.
And moving on to the strike itself tomorrow, where will the strikes be?
We have about 100 strikes going, and the big one in Sydney is in the Domain. It's at 12 p.m. till 2 p.m. Yeah, and then we also have strikes in regional areas like Wollongong, Coffs Harbour and such, so they're just all across.
And it looks like there's going to be a couple of other strikes going on as well around the Domain, so strikes coming up from University of Sydney, UTS, Mason's Point.
Yeah, the universities have been very, very supportive. UTS has helped us with a lot of the design for the banners and everything. So they've been amazing, and they're having their own strikes, and they're coming along and supporting us. So it's going to be a mass mobilization tomorrow.
So when all of these strikes and rallies all come together at the Domain for midday tomorrow, what will they be expecting?
I think what they're expecting is empowerment, some sort of way to put pressure on our politicians to get the government to action that we need for a sustainable future. I think they're expecting just a mass mobilization. So we're trying to aim for a lot more than last time. Last time we had about 30,000, and this time we're looking for a little bit more since it is a global strike. So that means that it's not just students, it's also the adults as well.
And who will they be able to hear talking or performing tomorrow at the strike in the Domain?
So we have performers such as Jack River and Montaigne, and we also have a couple student performances. And then after the strike finishes, we also have more student performances because we also want to allow some students to get a bit of exposure in that sense. And then we also have speakers from the Indigenous. We have them from the Pacific, and then we also have a firefighter speaking, and then a union worker, as well as two MCs from the core team for School Strike for Climate.
So it looks like it's going to be a school strike tomorrow, but will adults be allowed to get involved as well?
Yeah, so it's not actually a school strike. It's a global strike, so that means that it's not targeted at just student demographics, but it's targeted at everyone. That's why we're also having union members attend the event, and they've been very supportive as well. So it's just for everyone. The Teachers Federation Union is coming. The Retired Teachers Federation Union is coming. So I think that just shows the different demographics that we have attending the strike tomorrow.
And could we see further strike action if not much progress is made at the UN Climate Change Summit next week?
Yeah, so we don't intend to keep doing more and more strikes. Like, there might be one more at the max, because we do understand that all movements need to be effective and efficient. And I think if we keep having strikes, then it won't be. So we hope to see some sort of governmental action with the mass number of people tomorrow. But I guess if we don't, we will try and find other ways about it too.
It was announced at the UN Australia would not be speaking. Do you think that this is a good sign? This is something that's going to be mentioned at the strike tomorrow?
Yeah, I definitely think it will be acknowledged. Obviously, we don't want to keep focusing on this pessimistic outlook that Australia tends to have on climate change, but we definitely do want to acknowledge that we aren't doing enough and that we need to do more. And I think that will be a really empowering factor in our strike.
What is the message that you want to send to the people in charge?
We want to tell them to give us some action, because right now we're seeing nothing. We're seeing our economy just becoming more and more reliant on coal, more coal mines opening, and instead we want to see them being closed. We want to see a just transition for coal workers, because we do understand that financial stability is important. So that's what we want, and that's what we hope our politicians understand tomorrow.
Reporter Kevin Suarez speaking to Varsha, a core member of the New South Wales and national teams for school strikes for climate.
Make vinyl culture come alive with Newtown Record Fair this October. Dive into 30,000 new and old vinyl records. Listen to live vinyl DJs and crate dig with local record sellers. Enjoy the full craft beer bar, great food and fun fresh vibe of an outdoor-indoor record fair. Presented by 2SER FM, Newtown Record Fair is on 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, October 5 in the back beer garden of the Dog and Family Friendly Bank Hotel on King Street, Newtown. NewtownRecordFair.com.au, vinyl sponsor of 2SER.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. The battle to pass the abortion reform bill has been continuing in the upper house of the New South Wales Parliament. The New South Wales upper house is debating multiple amendments, and Rebel Liberal MPs Tanya Davies and Kevin Connolly have four of them, warning they will cross the floor if it comes to that. Talia Kreft spoke to Margaret Thornton, an Emeritus Professor of Law at the Australian National University, to ask just where the bill is right now.
Well, at the moment, it's proposed that there be a number of amendments. I understand there are something like 30 on the table, and two so far have been discussed, or they've been reported, and both of them have failed, brought by Conservative MPs.
What is the risk of the bill not being approved?
It looks at the moment, given the numbers, that it would probably get through as proposed. I mean, it was successful in the lower house. And if we look at one of the amendments, which was about sex selection, which was moved by the finance minister, Damien Tudorhope, who's, I think, a National Party member, together with a Labor MLC, Penny Sharp, well, that lost. And it was 15 votes in favour and 26 against. So that's quite a significant majority opposed that change. So, you know, on the basis of that, it looks as though the bill will go through. Or there might be a few sort of odd amendments or concessions made. And so one example was the proposal that was put forth by Neil Blair, who's a Nationals MP, which he thought was unnecessary, but nevertheless proposed it in the interests of community concern. And this was that doctors must provide appropriate care to babies born alive after a termination. Now, this is a very weird amendment. It's actually been passed. It's weird because all doctors swear a Hippocratic oath, which means that they're, you know, actually obliged then to do the best they can in terms of supporting life. So that's an odd amendment to include.
Yeah, what risk is there that the bill could be amended as Liberal, Conservatives Tanya Davies and Kevin Connolly are pushing for, and in what way do they want it amended?
Obviously, they're opposed and, you know, want it to be much more stringent. But based on the experience so far, I think that that's unlikely, although there might be some of these sort of odd concessions made, as in the case of the Neil Blair example, you know, having something that's completely unnecessary, which he himself admitted was not necessary to include this. And so that's a sort of weird thing about, you know, having a provision that doctors take appropriate care of babies born alive. Well, as though a doctor was just going to leave a baby without care.
Which state MPs have been opposing the bill?
I think I don't know the names of all of them, but I think it's interesting to note that in the proposal regarding sex selection, that one of the movers was actually a Labor MLC, Penny Sharp. So it's clearly not divided absolutely on party lines here, that there are going to be some members of the Labor Party who are probably more conservatively inclined or perhaps have religious views, I don't know, as well as the more conservative MPs that we've found for years, I mean, such as Fred Nile, who've taken a stance in terms of what looks like not just religious scruples, but also the desire to subordinate women. Well, I think that the majority of her party are supportive of her, which means it's unlikely to go through, and they know that that would actually be highly destabilising. I think the problem is with a, well, if you like, the extreme right of her party, and just as we found at the federal level. With the Turnbull government, there are a small number of ultra-conservatives who are prepared to throw their weight around.
How will the abortion law reform change how the current reproductive health bill stands?
Well, if it goes through as it did at the lower house, it would mean that women in New South Wales would be entitled to have an abortion up to 22 weeks. There was an attempt to limit that to 20 weeks, but that failed. So it would be legal up to 22 weeks, and after that, there would be two doctors involved who would make a determination in terms of the health and physical and mental health of the woman. And I mean that is similar to all other states. So for years. In South Australia, I think it's about 40 years. The period there is up to 28 weeks, but two doctors then do make an assessment based on the physical and mental health of the woman or whether the fetus has a serious abnormality. And all other jurisdictions also have a period of time when any woman can apply for an abortion. So it's from 14 weeks in the Northern Territory and 16 in Tasmania, 20 in Western Australia, 24 in Victoria. So you can see we have quite a variation. But New South Wales would then, you know, if the 22 were you know, that went through, that would be more or less in accordance with what we find elsewhere, and that would be the same as in Queensland. So the Queensland law was changed only last year.
Emeritus Professor of Law at the Australian National University, Margaret Thornton, speaking there with Talia Kreft.
American alt-rock legends The Flaming Lips make their opera house debut over two nights this September. Celebrating 20 years since the release of their psych pop opus, The Soft Bulletin, the band, renowned as one of the greatest live acts in the world, will play their classic album in full alongside their greatest hits. Book now for The Flaming Lips, September 30 and October 1 at sydneyoperahouse.com. Sponsors of 2SER.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge, coming to you live from this place known as Sydney, on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, of which sovereignty was never ceded. Well, legal firm Slater and Gordon has announced a class action lawsuit against the Department of Human Services Automated Debt Recovery System, also known as RoboDebt. Shadow Social Services Minister Bill Shorten has come out in full support of the lawsuit. The system has targeted thousands of young people around Australia, including many right here in Sydney. Eva Blakemore has this report.
Earlier this week, law firm Slater and Gordon announced that it was bringing a class action lawsuit against the Department of Human Services and its online compliance system, commonly known as RoboDebt. The system used data matching technology with the Australian Tax Office to create and send automated debt notices to Centrelink users. Terry Carney is an Emeritus Professor of Law at Sydney University and the longest-serving member of Australia's Government Review Tribunal. As a first-hand witness to some of the RoboDebt cases, he says the system has been flawed from the start.
The preliminary findings that I came to were that it was unlawful because it reversed the onus of proof. That's a simple point.
He says the government has already been forced to throw out hundreds of debt cases and have chosen to keep that from public record.
Despite having a few hundred of those decisions overturned, Centrelink never once exercised its right to go to the next level of the tribunal where the hearing would be public. And why hasn't it done that? My view is because it doesn't have a leg to stand on, legally speaking.
There isn't just that legal flaw. As Professor Carney says, there's also a simpler issue within the RoboDebt system's mathematics.
I mean, it's just the sort of silly, nonsensical arithmetic that a primary school kid knows about.
Many people have already been intimidated into paying their debt, afraid that their professional reputations could be at risk.
Many, many people, very intelligent people, just simply say, oh, well, look, Centrelink must be right, and I better pay up because, you know, this is going to be a blot on the copybook. What's my employer going to think? And, you know, that's not a small question. If it's a law graduate, whether a person disclosed a Centrelink debt like that or not goes to their fitness to practice. They could, in fact, if you like, lose their job.
These fears have already been felt by around 160,000 Australians who've been given debt notices totalling $2.4 billion. However, Professor Carney questions the legitimacy of those debt claims, saying that many don't even exist.
Nearly all of those debts are either highly inflated or they're totally false. You know, basically boils down to a tax that's being extracted from the most vulnerable of Australian citizens. It's an outrage.
The lawsuit comes off the back of data released by the Department of Human Services stating over 2,030 Australians died after receiving their debt notices in 2018. 20-year-old university student Bianca Snodgrass says she was very nearly one of those statistics.
I called up immediately and was like, I'm so sorry, what the hell is going on? And I was told that I needed to pay it back immediately or else I would be charged with fraud and I would need to go to court.
At just 18 and living in student housing, Bianca was served a debt notice stating that she owed the government $2,160 in undeclared income from when she was just 14. That night, Bianca called a suicide hotline.
I literally called Lifeline that night because I was going to commit suicide because I thought I owed the Australian government $2,160 that I didn't have.
Bianca says that throughout the ordeal, Centrelink staff have been unhelpful, leaving her without payment or assistance for over 2 months.
It would have been, I think, about two and a half months of just being so anxious that something was going to happen to me. I kid you not, I remember the name. His name was Peter. He sounded really young. He could hear me crying and he said, look, it's just honestly not really my problem. I've told you what you need to do. If you don't do this, then we're going to take you to court and you're going to be charged with fraud.
Professor Carney says that this kind of treatment by the government leads to allegations of extortion.
The high proportion of people who are unemployed, who have mental health issues, who are lacking in confidence, who don't have access to advice and information, it's outrageous. It's why many people say it's a form of extortion. It's the government using its extensive power and intimidation in order to extract funds from people who are too frightened or too ill-informed to know how to go about setting the record straight and getting the debt entirely expunged.
Bianca was unfortunately one of those people and says she felt she didn't have the tools to fight a debt so young.
I didn't know anything. I had no idea what was happening. I didn't know what kind of words to use. I didn't know how to phrase anything. I couldn't get out the sentence of, like, I have a debt, but it's not correct. It's not my debt. without crying.
Bianca says these instances aren't rare, as more and more people fall victim to Centrelink's increasingly automated services.
It's terrible. I know a few other people who have had this happen, like my roommate. She goes through something like this almost every 6 months. Every 6 months, they're like, actually, we're not going to give you any more payments.
Professor Carney maintains that the systems delivering these notices are without legal basis and says he's hopeful that the class action proves that.
But actually, at no point ever has any government or Centrelink or any other spokesperson ever even hinted at what they think is the basis for their bland assertion that this is a legal program. If it's a legal program, show me your proof.
Emeritus Professor of Law at Sydney University, Terry Carney, ending that report by Eva Blakemore.
This is Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3.
A new report by Demographia has named Sydney the world's third worst city for housing affordability, which will come as a surprise to few of us. Inequality is becoming the political buzzword of the decade, and while parties may like to bandy around differing figures, the fact remains that while younger people are priced out of the housing market, they will suffer from much higher levels of inequality. I spoke to Brendan Coates, Household Finances Program Director at the Grattan Institute, to ask whether he was surprised by Sydney's latest poor ranking.
No, house prices have been rising in Australia and in Sydney in particular over the course of the last couple of decades. You know, when you've got price-to-income ratios in Sydney's where the average house is worth 10 to 12 times the average income, then you know you've got a real problem, and you can see that in the number of Sydney-siders that are really struggling to afford housing, that are either having to move out of the city or choose to have a house on the urban fringe where they're so far from jobs, transport and services, that it really makes life quite hard.
What difference does that make then to the city itself if there's a kind of drain out to the outer suburbs?
Well, ultimately, housing policy is economic policy. So, you know, there are a large number of costs that come from not building enough housing and for Sydney-siders to not be able to afford housing near where they work and where they'd like to live. So, you know, we know that there are huge payoffs to having denser cities. The agglomeration scale economies are very large. And they're basically what we lose, because it means that people don't take that job that will give them a higher income, or people don't open that business basically because they can't get to where their customers are or where employment would be. And that means ultimately that we're all left poorer than we otherwise would be.
So we know that we're seeing a bit of a generational change in that fewer young people are buying their own homes. What kind of difference does home ownership make to inequality?
Well, the issue here is that there's a growing divide between the housing haves and the housing have-nots. And that is really starkly a problem for particularly the bottom 40% of Australians by income. So 3 decades ago, your chances of owning your own home were roughly the same, regardless of what your income was. Those that were wealthy were just as likely to own homes as the poor. Fast forward to today, that's no longer the case. Home ownership has crashed amongst younger, poorer Australians, and that's going to have enormous consequences for how our society functions. The most obvious one is actually how in retirement. Historically, 75% of Australians have owned their own homes in retirement. Now we're probably looking, going forward a couple of decades, that number is going to be closer to 50 to 60%. Amongst poorer Australians, a minority will own their own homes in retirement. And we know from the data today that those that don't own their own homes, if you're renting in retirement, you do tend to experience a lot of financial stress and life's going to get pretty tough. And we're going to see so many more people in that situation in future because housing is increasingly unaffordable.
What about the strain on the public purse from that growing number of people who don't have their own homes?
Well, the real challenge, and this is one for the government through its flagged retirement incomes review, is really going to have to tackle, which is we're going to get a review that shows that this problem is unfolding and that rent assistance, Commonwealth rent assistance, which is paid to pensioners and to working age Australians on income support that rent, that number is manifestly inadequate. So the rate is linked to into inflation. It doesn't rise with rents, which means it's lost quite a lot of its value compared to the rents people are paying over the last 20 years. And so we're recommending a 40% increase in rent assistance, which would cost the government about $1.2 billion a year. In fact, in future, more will probably be needed. And so the costs to the government from this change are actually rather substantial. And it's something that the government is going to have to grapple with. And the best solution here is to try to head it off at the pass by making housing more affordable, by fixing our planning system to allow more housing to be built, by fixing the tax system so we're not subsidising home ownership and housing as much. And in the long run, we can have a better, fairer Australia, which is kind of what all Australians want, where they can all get the kind of housing that they want and still realise the great Australian dream.
How realistic is seeing that kind of addressing of housing inequality in the near future?
Look, it's an issue. It's ultimately down to the politics. In the last two decades, Australian governments of both state and federal have done the things that sound good but don't make much of a difference, rather than the kind of policies in housing that would make a big difference that tend to be politically contentious. So the things that would make a big difference are relaxing planning rules to allow more homes to be built in the inner and middle ring suburbs of our major cities, particularly in Sydney. It is changing tax policies like negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount, or the fact that the family home is largely exempt from the assets test. So you can be a pensioner, own your own home in retirement and get the pension, but if you had the same assets outside your home, you don't. These are things that are very politically contentious. But the reality is Australians have been told for the last two decades, don't worry, that we've got ways to fix this problem, it'll be fine. And those things, like first-time owners grants, have ended up making the problem worse. And until we sort of fess up or confront the Australian public with the reality that it's going to take some serious policy changes to get this over the line, to make improvements, then we're likely to see the problem get worse rather than better.
How desperate is it right now?
Well, we're seeing a crash in home ownership. That's going to flow through over the course of the next two decades. We're seeing poor Australians struggling to pay their rents. So housing costs have risen a lot at the bottom, and that is why income inequality hasn't risen that much in Australia in the last decade. Incomes at the top have risen only slightly more than incomes at the bottom. But income inequality after housing costs, so once you've subtracted out what you're spending on housing, have gone up a lot. And so it is a real problem that I think Australia needs to grapple with. We can fix it, but only if governments really take the lead in confronting the Australian population, the Australian public, about what needs to change.
I'd just like to turn a little bit now to the more specific case of social housing. You've spoken about the disproportionate effect on poorer Australians. We know that there's a real shortfall when it comes to social housing. In fact, if anything, more is being sold off. What are some of the issues there?
So the big issue here is that the social housing stock is not growing. So social housing is currently about 4.5% of all housing in Australia. And what that means, we're not building very much. What it means is that for people who find themselves on really hard times today, there's no new stock available for them to move into to help give them a leg up. Because most of the people who live in social housing today, most tenants are older, and they're probably going to be there for another two decades. And that's the key challenge, is that we need to be building enough so that those who are finding themselves on really hard times that otherwise would be homeless have somewhere to go. The problem is it's not cheap. So to build 10,000 new social housing dwellings, you know, you're talking about spending something like, you know, you'd be talking about spending $2 to $3 billion in order to get those built. That's an enormous amount of money, and that's why governments have not wanted to tackle this problem, because it is frankly so expensive.
Brendan Coates, Household Finances Program Director at the Grattan Institute, speaking with me there. Well, that's all we have time for tonight. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. Catch us again Thursday nights at 7:30 p.m. I'm Daniel Butler. Till next time.